In October 2011, 5-year-old Jessie Shockley disappeared from her Glendale apartment, leaving behind locked doors and a terrified family. The case ignited a firestorm of suspicion when investigators quickly zeroed in on her mother, Jairus Hunter, designating her the prime suspect before a single body was found. Despite a fierce public outcry, the media fixated on Hunter's criminal record instead of the missing child. The family believed the case slipped beneath the radar because Jessie was black and poor. Amid protests at the state capitol, every unanswered question and ignored lead boiled over into rage and heartbreak. With no body and no clear motive, the official narrative fractured, raising urgent questions. Did law enforcement fail a little girl? Or did society ignore her because of race and class? So, if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. It was October 11th, 2011. The air in Glendale, Arizona hung heavy with heat, even though summer had officially passed. Inside a modest apartment complex on 45th Avenue and Glendale, 5-year-old Jessie Shockley was getting ready for the day like any other. Her older siblings had just left for school. The apartment door was locked. She was home alone. That was the last time anyone ever saw her alive. Her mother, Jairus Hunter, told police that she had only been gone for a short while, running errands, picking up one of the older children from an appointment. She insisted she locked the door when she left, but when she returned later that day, something was off. The door was ajar. Jessie was gone. Jairus panicked. She began knocking on neighbors' doors. No one had seen anything. No sounds, no cries, nothing out of place. By 5 p.m., the Glendale Police Department was called, and within hours, Jessie's name was officially entered into the National Crime Information Center database. Officers canvassed the neighborhood and began their search. Helicopters swept the skies. Police dogs combed alleys and dry desert brush. Tips flooded in from the local community. There was a brief hope. Maybe she wandered off. Maybe she was hiding. Maybe someone would return her safely. But that hope didn't last long. Detectives found no sign of forced entry, no indication of struggle, no witnesses. Jessie had simply vanished. She didn't take any toys. She didn't leave the apartment with anyone, as far as anyone knew. It was as if the 5-year-old had disappeared into thin air. Within 24 hours, the focus of the investigation began to shift, a shadow in the past. As officers spoke with family members and reviewed the details, they discovered Jairus Hunter's criminal record. In 2006, she had served more than 3 years in a California prison for abusing her older children, locking them in closets, beating them, denying them food. It wasn't long before Child Protective Services stepped in and removed Jessie's siblings from the home again. What had started as a missing child case quickly became something else. Reporters who had initially covered Jessie's disappearance began asking about Jairus's past. The language in the headlines shifted. Mother of missing girl has child abuse record. Convicted felon pleads for child's return. The public's attention, what little of it there was, began to fade from Jessie and settle squarely on her mother. Inside police headquarters, detectives pressed harder. They questioned Jairus repeatedly. They visited the home with forensic units, tearing through rooms and collecting evidence. They seized Jairus's car. They collected trash bins from the neighborhood, but no body, no confession, no clear lead. Then came the closet. Investigators claimed they found traces of blood inside a bedroom closet. They didn't say whose blood it was, but it was enough to send alarms through the department. If Jessie had been injured or killed inside the apartment, this was the first sign of it. Still, no DNA results were immediately released, and Jairus denied everything. "I would never hurt my baby," she said at a press conference. "I want her back more than anything. I just want people to look for her, Stop looking at me. The silence of the system. For many in the community, it felt like the case had stalled before it had even started. There were no Amber Alerts, no breaking news headlines outside Arizona. Unlike other missing children, Kaylee Anthony, Elizabeth Smart, Lisa Irwin, Jesse Shockley's name didn't make the rounds on cable news. No national outrage, no candlelight vigils broadcast to the country. Instead, it was her family, her grandmother, cousins, neighbors, who organized search parties and passed out flyers. They marched through Phoenix with posters and megaphones. They knocked on doors themselves. "We just want to find her," her grandmother Shirley Johnson told reporters. "If it were a little white girl from Scottsdale, the whole world would be looking. But Jessie is just a poor black girl from the wrong zip code." For Jairus, the walls were closing in. CPS had her other children. Police had her under surveillance. Reporters were circling like vultures. Yet no one had found Jessie. The community began to divide. Some believed Jairus had to be guilty. Others thought she was being demonized, punished more for her past than for any proof in the present. Either way, the case was spiraling fast. And still, there was no child, no trace, and no one else considered a suspect. The vanishing becomes a storm. As the days turned into weeks, the case shifted again, not toward resolution, but toward silence. The flyers yellowed on utility poles. Police stopped holding regular press conferences. Public interest faded. But behind closed doors, investigators were building a different kind of case. A case not of a girl lost, but of a mother accused. They began piecing together statements from Jairus's older children. They spoke of punishments, of being locked in closets, of their baby sister screaming. The prosecution didn't have a body, but they were starting to gather a story. Whether it was the truth, or a story shaped to fit a missing narrative, would be the question that haunted this case for years. In the days following Jesse Shockley's disappearance, a wave of anxiety rolled through her community. Flyers with her smiling face blanketed storefronts and bus stops. Her eyes looked directly into the camera, her small lips pressed in a hopeful grin that broke the hearts of those who saw it. But something else was happening in the background. There was no Amber Alert, no breaking headlines from major national networks, no interviews on CNN, no full-scale federal task force. Not like with Elizabeth Smart, not like JonBenet Ramsey, not like Lisa Irwin. Despite Jessie being only 5 years old, black, and last seen alone in her apartment, her case didn't seem to register at the same level, and people noticed. Her grandmother, Shirley Johnson, began speaking publicly about what she saw as a double standard. She didn't hold back. In press interviews and on the Capitol steps, she said what others were afraid to, that Jessie's disappearance was being ignored because of who she was and who she wasn't. "She's not blonde. She's not rich. She's not from the suburbs," Shirley said. "She's a little black girl from Glendale, and nobody cares." The coverage that did emerge wasn't about Jessie. It was about her mother. Character assassination in real time. Reporters dug up Jairus Hunter's criminal history and splashed it across the news. They used old mugshots. They ran headlines like, "Mother of missing girl has violent past and convicted felon pleads for help." And with that shift, the public turned. Whispers became judgments. Sympathy for a missing child morphed into suspicion of a mother. The complexity of Jairus's past, her previous abuse charges, her prison time, her attempts to rebuild, were flattened into one damning label: monster. Online comment sections filled with venom. People stopped asking where Jessie was. They started asking how long it would take to arrest Jairus. It didn't matter that there was no physical evidence tying her to a crime. It didn't matter that there was no witness who saw her hurt her daughter. The press had built a villain, and that image stuck. Meanwhile, the search for Jesse faded into the background. There were no new leads, no press briefings. It was like she'd disappeared twice, once from her apartment and once from public memory. Protests at the state capitol. But her family refused to let her be forgotten. In January 2012, just 3 months after Jesse vanished, her relatives organized a protest outside the Arizona state capitol. Dozens showed up, holding signs that read, "Justice for Jesse," "Black girls matter too," and "We won't be silent." Shirley Johnson spoke through a bullhorn. Her voice cracked with grief and fury as she called out reporters, politicians, and law enforcement. "You all gave JonBenet years of coverage. You gave Kaylee Anthony daily reports. But my grandbaby, she's invisible. Why?" The protest drew some local attention, but not the national headlines they'd hoped for. Still, it ignited a conversation, quiet at first, but growing louder, about the racial disparities in missing children cases, missing white woman syndrome. Activists and academics began connecting Jesse's case to a broader trend, what media critics call missing white woman syndrome. It's the phenomenon where disappearances of young, white, middle-class women receive wall-to-wall coverage, while missing Black, Indigenous, or Latino children are often sidelined. They pointed to the numbers. At the time, Black children made up about 33% of all missing kids in the U.S., despite being only 14% of the population. Yet they received only a fraction of the news coverage. Families had to fight to get airtime, beg for help, plead for the same urgency granted to others. Shirley Johnson wasn't an activist by trade. She wasn't trained in media relations. But her words cut through. "If you're Black and your child goes missing, you better solve it yourself." A shift in tone, but not in action. By early 2012, the Glendale Police Department finally began referring to Jesse's disappearance as a homicide investigation. But they offered no new evidence, no body, no arrest. Detectives still refused to name any other suspects. When asked why they believed Jesse was dead, their answers were vague, based on evidence gathered. But no one outside the department knew what that evidence was. The public was expected to believe what they were told. For the family, it felt like a second betrayal. First, the system failed to protect Jesse. Then, it failed to look for her. And now, it was laying the groundwork to convict someone, her mother, without even saying why. And through it all, there was a little girl, missing. No grave, no goodbye, the growing divide. The community splintered. Some believed the mother must have done it. Why else would the police focus on her? Others believed Jairus was a scapegoat, someone easy to blame because of her past and her poverty. They didn't see a monster. They saw a system trying to save face. "She made mistakes, yes," one local pastor said at a vigil. "But we don't convict people for who they were. We search for justice based on who they are now. Where is the child? That's the question." But that question faded more with each passing day. Search teams were called off. The news cycle moved on. The flyers wilted in the sun. And Jesse's name began to fall into silence, until an arrest changed everything. By late 2012, the public narrative was firmly cemented, even though no body had ever been found. Jesse Shockley was still missing. Her remains had never turned up in the desert brush or in any of the hundreds of dumpsters searched in and around Glendale. No witnesses ever claimed to have seen her taken. No video surfaced showing her leaving the apartment. Still, the police had made up their minds, and so had most of the media. The suspect? Her own mother, Jairus Hunter. There were no other persons of interest. No outside abduction theory being considered. From law enforcement's perspective, the case was closed in everything but name. But how do you charge a mother with murder when you don't have a body? The answer, it turns out, lies not in what they found, but in what they believed. the closet. In the weeks following Jesse's disappearance, Glendale police quietly conducted several forensic sweeps of the apartment. In one of the bedrooms, inside a hallway closet, investigators claimed they discovered evidence of bloodstains. Later reports suggested the blood was consistent with human tissue breakdown, an indication, they said, of decomposition. That conclusion, however, was never definitively confirmed by any released DNA test. Instead, police relied on something else: testimony. Testimony from Jesse's older siblings, children who had been removed from the home and placed in protective custody. According to investigators, one of the children claimed they had seen their mother hit Jesse in the face, causing her to fall and bleed. Another alleged that Jesse was often locked in that same closet as punishment, sometimes for hours, even days. They said she would scream and beg to come out, that she was denied food, that she began to look sick and weak. Most disturbing of all, one sibling allegedly told police that sometime before the disappearance, Jesse had been seen with bruises all over her body, and then she was simply gone. It was chilling testimony. It was also circumstantial. No other adults confirmed these claims. No neighbors reported hearing screams. No teachers had raised alarms. Still, it was enough for police to act. The arrest. On September 6, 2012, nearly 11 months after Jesse was reported missing, Jairus Hunter was arrested and charged with first-degree murder and child abuse. The charges stunned the community. It was the first major development in months, but it came with a bitter twist. There was still no body. No physical confirmation that Jesse was even dead. For the prosecutors, this was a bold move. Cases without a body are notoriously difficult to win. Juries tend to be skeptical. They want proof. They want something tangible. But the state believed they had enough. They had the testimony of the siblings. They had Jairus's history of abuse. They had alleged inconsistencies in her police interviews. And they had a mother who, to many, never looked remorseful enough. Once again, public perception split in two. Some saw justice finally being served. Others saw a rush to convict a woman the system had never truly forgiven. Media reactions. As soon as Jairus's mugshot appeared on the evening news, the tone of the coverage shifted again. The disappearance of a little girl was no longer the headline. Now, it was a trial. A crime story. A spectacle. News anchors replayed clips of Jairus at press conferences. Her words. Her body language. Her perceived lack of emotion. Experts were invited to speculate. Does she look guilty? Why hasn't she confessed? Could a mother really do this? Few focused on the fact that no forensic evidence had ever been made public, that the supposed blood in the closet had never been conclusively linked to Jesse, that the case hinged almost entirely on statements made by traumatized children under state custody. The narrative was set. A mother with a dark past had committed the unthinkable. And the world moved on. No body, no burial. Behind the headlines, Jesse's body remained missing. Search teams had combed through landfills, dug through trash, and investigated nearby desert terrain. At one point, a months-long excavation of a local dump brought hope that something might be found. But after weeks of sifting through more than 6,000 tons of garbage, investigators came up empty. No remains, no clothing, no final clue. Her family was left in a kind of purgatory, grieving a child declared dead without ever being laid to rest. They held vigils and lit candles, but there was no grave to visit, no place to leave flowers, just a bedroom with her toys and memories that wouldn't fade. "We don't even have a body," Shirley Johnson told reporters. "How do you bury a ghost?" A divided city. Glendale itself seemed split down the middle. One side saw a justice system finally doing its job. They believed Jairus's prior record made the charges credible. They trusted the testimony of the children and the gut instinct of the police. The other side saw something more insidious, a rushed case, a media smear campaign, and a mother demonized because of poverty, race, and past mistakes. They asked hard questions. If this had been a white woman in a wealthy suburb, would she have been given the benefit of the doubt? The truth, many felt, was buried somewhere in the middle. But without a body, there were no answers, only theories, only pain. And soon, a trial would begin, a trial that would try to answer a question no one had been able to prove. Where was Jesse Shockley? By early 2013, the silence surrounding Jesse Shockley's disappearance had become unbearable for her family. With Jairus Hunter behind bars awaiting trial, the case had all but vanished from the news. No new leads, no updates, and still, no body. The family had waited. They had cooperated. They had begged for attention. But now, they were ready to make noise. So, on a cool January morning, they marched on the Arizona State Capitol. Shirley Johnson, Jesse's grandmother, and the family's most vocal advocate, led the protest. She stood tall in front of news cameras, holding a large sign with Jesse's photo, her sweet, round face frozen in time. Around her, supporters wore matching shirts that read, "We are Jesse." They weren't just protesting her disappearance. They were protesting what they saw as a complete collapse of justice, a grandmother's roar. "We're not going to stop," Shirley told the small crowd gathered on the Capitol lawn. Her voice trembled, not from fear, but from the exhaustion of carrying this burden alone. "For months, we asked for help, for coverage, for attention. Nobody listened. Nobody looked. And now, you want to throw her mother away without even showing us our baby's body?" She looked into the cameras. "If she had blonde hair and blue eyes, you'd know her name. You'd say it every night on the news." The crowd murmured in agreement. Signs waved through the air. Some read, "Justice for Jesse." Others simply said, "Why no Amber Alert?" It wasn't just about Jairus anymore. It was about what her granddaughter's case revealed, about race, about class, about whose lives matter when the cameras are rolling. A system under scrutiny. The protest outside the Capitol marked a turning point. While it didn't ignite nationwide headlines, it caught the attention of local leaders and forced the public to confront uncomfortable truths. For the first time, politicians were being asked, why wasn't an Amber Alert issued? Why did the media coverage dry up within weeks? Why was there so little transparency about the evidence? And why was no one else ever considered a suspect? Activists began pointing to broader patterns. Missing children from marginalized communities, especially Black and Indigenous families, were often ignored, underreported, or assumed to be runaways. Law enforcement, they argued, was quicker to criminalize parents than to investigate all possibilities. To many, Jairus Hunter's history of abuse had made her an easy target. But even those who didn't defend her believed the case had been handled recklessly. If the goal was to find Jesse, why had the search stopped so quickly? The media's second silence. After Jairus's arrest, the press all but closed the book on the case. There was no daily coverage of the investigation, no pressure on the police department to keep the public updated. The disappearance of a 5-year-old girl had become yesterday's news. Shirley Johnson and her family knew exactly why. "Let's be honest," she told a reporter that day. "People don't care about Black children, not unless they can turn them into a suspect or a tragedy they can control." Her words weren't hyperbole. They were backed by statistics and echoed by families across the country who had fought similar battles. Cases like Jesse's were often invisible unless something scandalous or photogenic caught the public's eye. At that protest, it wasn't just her family grieving. It was a community grieving its place in the system, grieving how easy it was for their children to disappear, echoes of the past. For some in Arizona, the case drew uncomfortable parallels to other historic injustices. The way Black families have often been portrayed as unstable, unfit, or criminal before facts are even confirmed. The way trauma is passed down through generations, mother to child, community to community, and never truly healed. But the protest was more than pain. It was defiance. People who felt ignored were demanding to be seen. Mothers who feared the same fate for their own children were shouting, "Never again." And a grandmother, fighting against time and doubt, was refusing to let her baby become a footnote. No answers, only accusations. Inside the courtroom, the prosecution remained tight-lipped. They claimed to have enough evidence for trial, but shared little publicly. There were whispers of hair fibers, blood traces, statements from the siblings. But there was still no body, no murder weapon, no witness to a crime. Jairus sat in jail, denied bail. Her defense attorneys filed motions, citing the lack of physical evidence. But the court was unmoved. Publicly, prosecutors insisted they had built a strong case. Privately, many questioned how strong it really was. Were they prosecuting Jairus because she was guilty? Or because they had no one else to blame? A family divided. A child forgotten. Even within the community, emotions were raw and complicated. Some supported Jairus, believing she was railroaded by a biased system. Others, recalling her abusive past, believed she had done something unthinkable. But nearly all agreed on one thing. Jesse had been forgotten. No one was searching anymore. No daily updates. No hope. The girl who vanished in her own home had also vanished from the national conscience. And for those who loved her, that was the greatest injustice of all. In February 2015, more than 3 years after Jesse Shockley vanished, the trial of Jairus Hunter finally began. There was no body, no eyewitness, no physical evidence directly linking Jairus to a murder. But prosecutors were confident. They believed they didn't need a body to prove guilt. They believed they had a pattern, a story, and enough shadows to convince a jury that light would never return. In the courtroom, Jairus sat still, her face unreadable. The press returned, hungry for headlines. The public watched, waiting to see how the state would make a murder case without the most basic proof a murder occurred. It was one of the rarest types of trials, a homicide without a corpse. The prosecution's story. From the outset, prosecutors laid out their narrative clearly. Jesse was dead, and her mother had killed her. They argued that Jairus was a violent, abusive parent with a proven history of harming her children. They told the jury about her 2006 California conviction for felony child abuse. They leaned heavily on her past, using it not just as context, but as a warning. This wasn't a grieving mother, they said. This was a repeat offender. The state then called upon key witnesses, Jesse's older siblings. One by one, they testified to years of abuse, locked closets, brutal beatings, long periods of isolation with no food or water. They claimed that in the weeks leading up to Jesse's disappearance, she had become frail and bruised. They described the bedroom closet as a place of punishment and said they believed Jesse died inside it. One sibling recalled seeing blood. Another remembered her looking sick and unable to walk. The jury listened in silence. Then came the most gut-wrenching claim, that after Jesse died, her mother stuffed her tiny body into a suitcase and disposed of it in a garbage bin. From there, prosecutors said it was likely transported to a local landfill, never to be found again. They had no surveillance video, no DNA from the suitcase, no confirming witness to the alleged disposal. But they had one weapon, the children's voices. The defense fights back. Jairus's defense team pushed hard against the testimony. They argued that the children, taken from their mother and placed in foster care, were manipulated, coached, even, to say what prosecutors needed to hear. they pointed out the inconsistencies in the timeline, the contradictions between statements made early in the case and those presented in court. They reminded the jury that no physical evidence, no body, no trace, no murder weapon had been recovered. The blood allegedly found in the closet, never definitively identified. The forensic tests, inconclusive or vague. The defense painted a picture of a mother whose past had already condemned her long before the trial began. A woman caught in a system that didn't see her as a person, only as a record. If Jairus Hunter were a white mother from Scottsdale, one defense attorney said in court, would we be here today without a body? The jury deliberates. For 4 weeks, the court heard arguments, testimony, and evidence, though much of the case was built on suggestion rather than certainty. Then it was in the jury's hands. They deliberated for 4 days. On April 17, 2015, the verdict came in. Guilty on all counts. First-degree murder, child abuse, concealment of a dead body. Jairus Hunter showed little emotion as the decision was read. Whether it was strength, numbness, or resignation, no one could say. The courtroom was still. Outside, reactions were swift and divided. Some said justice had been served. Others said it was a modern-day lynching, punishment without proof, conviction without closure, a sentence without closure. Later that summer, Jairus was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge called the crime cruel, horrific, and heartless. Prosecutors praised the verdict. They said justice had finally caught up. But outside the courtroom, people still whispered, "Where is Jesse?" How do you close a case without a body, without confirming a death? And what does justice mean when it comes without answers? A community left behind. After the trial, Jesse's case disappeared once more from the headlines. With Jairus in prison, there was no new drama to feed the news cycle. The landfill searches stopped. The public moved on. But for her family, especially her grandmother, it was far from over. Shirley Johnson still spoke at community events. She still showed up with flyers. She still held hope, if not for Jesse's safe return, then at least for her remains to be found, for peace, for closure. "It's not over," she told a local reporter. "You can't bury a case when you haven't buried the child." A conviction built on memory. The state won its case, but in doing so, it opened a troubling conversation about how far the justice system is willing to stretch when pressed for results. Can you prove murder with no body? Can you believe traumatized children as the sole foundation of a case? Can a past crime become your present punishment, even if the evidence is thin? For many, the answer was yes. For others, it was a chilling reminder of how race, history, and perception shape the courtroom as much as evidence. And somewhere, in an unmarked place, the question still echoed, "Where is Jesse Shockley?" Months after the trial, Jairus Hunter sat in Perryville Prison, serving a life sentence. She had been tried, convicted, and locked away for the murder of her daughter, a murder for which no remains had ever been found. Outside the prison walls, time moved forward. But for the people still searching for truth, one question remained frozen. Where is Jesse? Her body had never been recovered. Not from the apartment. Not from the surrounding streets. Not from the landfill where police once claimed she had been discarded. She had simply vanished. The landfill search. Back in early 2012, before Jairus was officially charged, Glendale police had pursued a theory that would come to define the rest of the investigation, that Jesse had been placed in a dumpster and that dumpster's contents had been transported to a nearby landfill. What followed was one of the most grueling and expensive searches in Arizona's history. Over the course of several months, law enforcement officials, aided by volunteers and forensic experts, combed through more than 6,500 tons of trash. They wore hazmat suits. They sifted through rotting food, broken glass, soiled clothes, and crushed furniture. They dug and dug, searching for even the smallest fragment of a clue. But they found nothing. No bones, no clothing, no hair, no blanket, no suitcase. Nothing that could be definitively tied to Jesse Shockley. And yet, this landfill theory remained the cornerstone of the state's case. A conviction without a discovery. Most murder trials end with a body, a crime scene, a death certificate, a cause of death. But this case had none of that. Jesse's body was never recovered. Her autopsy never performed. The cause and manner of her death officially remain unknown. Prosecutors had argued that wasn't necessary. The absence of a body didn't mean the absence of a crime. And legally, they were right. But emotionally and morally, the absence was devastating. For her family, especially her grandmother, Shirley Johnson, the pain wasn't just that Jesse was gone. It was that no one ever brought her home. Shirley continued to visit the field behind the landfill where the search had taken place, not because she expected to find her granddaughter, but because it was the last place anyone had looked. "She's still out there," she told reporters. "Somewhere. Maybe not where they said, but somewhere. A grave without a name." In many ways, Jesse had become a ghost. Not in the supernatural sense, but in how easily she had been erased. There was no funeral, no coffin, no cemetery plot, no stone etched with her name, just a story. A story told in courtrooms, in headlines, in whispers. Her mother sat behind bars. Her siblings were scattered through the foster system. The neighborhood where she once lived barely remembered her name. And her photograph, once taped to telephone poles and storefront windows, had faded in the Arizona sun. People moved on, but the absence stayed. The weight of uncertainty, the absence of remains, raised questions that refused to die. What if Jesse was never killed? What if someone else took her? What if she was still alive, somewhere, and no one was looking? These weren't wild conspiracy theories. They were the natural byproducts of a case built on everything but hard proof. Even some of the jurors, after voting to convict, admitted the lack of a body had haunted them during deliberations. They were forced to rely on trust, on the testimony of children, on the idea that no other explanation made sense, but justice without certainty has a price. And in this case, that price was clarity, a system without resolve. Law enforcement has never reopened the investigation. As far as the Glendale Police Department is concerned, the case is closed. The conviction stands. The outcome is final. But the public's faith? That was another story. Many who followed the case still question how confidently police ruled out other scenarios, why they hadn't pursued other leads, why the search had stopped as soon as Jarris was arrested. Why the landfill theory had become the only theory. For families of missing children, there is nothing more terrifying than the possibility that your child's case will be solved only on paper, not in real life. Legacy in limbo. Jesse Shockley should have turned 18 in 2024. She should have had a driver's license, a high school diploma, a birthday party with candles and cake. Instead, she has a conviction with no grave, a legacy shaped by absence, and for the people who loved her, the grief is still raw, still unanswered. They hold on to what they can. The sound of her voice in old videos, the photographs from preschool, the drawings she once taped to the fridge, and the hope, faint, flickering, that one day someone will find what everyone else gave up searching for. Not just a child, but the truth. By the time the national news cycle had forgotten her name, Jesse Shockley had already become something more than a missing child. She had become a symbol, not just of loss or tragedy, but of a deeper truth that still unsettles America. that not all missing children are searched for equally. That justice can feel more like a verdict than a discovery. And that sometimes, when the headlines fade, the pain sharpens. Years had passed since her disappearance, and still, there was no grave, no memorial service, no clear answer. But in the silence, something had grown. A reckoning. A family still fighting. Shirley Johnson, now older and weathered by grief, never stopped speaking her granddaughter's name. She attended town halls. She sat through public forums on child advocacy. She pressed lawmakers about racial disparities in missing persons cases. At every opportunity, she told the story of a bright 5-year-old who disappeared from her own apartment, who was never seen again, whose case was closed without a body, whose mother was convicted, but whose remains were never returned. "It's not about whether you think Jairus is guilty," she often said. "It's about the fact that they stopped looking for a baby, and they shouldn't have." Her voice didn't always make the front page, but it echoed through communities where people recognized the patterns of neglect, of silence, of unequal urgency. The larger pattern. Jesse's story was not unique. In fact, that's what made it so painful. Across the country, Black children were, and still are, overrepresented on missing persons lists. Yet they remain underrepresented in media coverage. Experts call it disparity bias. Families call it heartbreak. In the decades since Jesse's case, multiple studies confirm what Shirley had been screaming from the Capitol steps: that children of color are far less likely to receive widespread attention when they go missing, that the Amber Alert effect works differently depending on your zip code, your skin tone, and your mother's history. Jesse had become a name in those reports, a case study, an example. But to her family, she was still a little girl who should have come home. What remains? In Glendale, the apartment complex where Jesse once lived is still standing. The paint is faded. The units have turned over. Few people remember the name of the girl who vanished behind one of those doors. Time has done what time always does. It's moved on. But traces of her remain, quiet ones. A child's chalk outline on the sidewalk, a sun-faded flyer pinned to a bulletin board, a neighbor who still whispers, "That poor baby," whenever her name is mentioned. And for her surviving siblings, now grown, the scars run deep. They were placed in foster homes, separated, some later adopted out. They carried with them not only the trauma of a missing sister, but also the burden of being called to testify in a trial against their own mother. For them, closure never came, only confusion, silence, and survival. The justice system's dilemma. To this day, Jairus Hunter maintains her innocence. She's filed appeals, written letters, claimed she was railroaded by a system that never gave her a fair chance. Whether people believe her or not, the case has raised uncomfortable questions. Can a court sentence someone to life in prison without a body and without conclusive forensic proof? Did the pressure to resolve a high-profile case override the need for airtight evidence? And when the media crafts a villain, can the justice system resist that story? Some say justice was done. Others say it was rushed, fueled by history, race, and reputation. But all agree on one point. Jesse Shockley disappeared, and no one has truly answered how. The girl who wasn't buried. In the end, this story is about absence. The absence of a child. The absence of a body. The absence of justice that feels complete. The absence of peace. For many, the case of Jesse Shockley lives in a kind of gray space, resolved on paper, but wide open in the hearts of those who followed it. A little girl, locked in memory but missing from the world. She never got a second chance. She never got to grow up. But what she left behind, what her story continues to show, is that justice in America is not always blind. Sometimes it's looking in the wrong direction. And sometimes the greatest tragedy isn't just that a child disappears. It's that the world stops looking.